Grace and peace to each of you as we gather today in the name of Christ. It's good to be gathered together this way, and shortly Dr. Harding will be introduced. But it is a privilege to have all you guests among us. It would be nice to go around and introduce yourself, but that might take the whole hour. But it's a pleasure to have you here. As a part of our crossing the threshold and being present here, Dr. Harding has invited us to reflect on the statement that is on the wall. So I'd invite us to read that together as we begin. It's also in your bulletin, by the way, if you would like to read it from there. Together, I choose to identify with the underprivileged. I choose to identify with the poor. I choose to give my life for the hungry. I choose to give my life for those who have been left out of the sunlight of opportunity. I choose to live for and with those who find themselves seeing life as a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. This is the way I am going. If it means suffering a little bit, I'm going that way. If it means sacrificing, I'm going that way. If it means dying for them, I'm going that way. Because I heard the voice saying, do something for others. Pray with me. Spirit of Christ, we invite you to open our hearts to the awareness of what it means to go that way. Be present among us in our song, in our listening, in our conversation, for the kingdom of God, in Jesus' name, amen.
Praise the one who raised the darkness to the living.
Yeah. Please stand for the reading of the Gospel, Matthew 25, 31 through 40. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at the right hand, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick and in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me.
Thank you. few words on the way to welcoming our special guest, one of thanks to Professor Mark Sawin, and a comment on the total lack of credibility I now have with Mark, because Mark was concerned about how many people might be here last night, and I assured him there wouldn't be a problem in terms of capacity, that I had hosted a special guest and was embarrassed because there were 20 people. So as this room filled and filled and filled, and the chairs and chairs and chairs had to be added all the way out nearly to the back of the auditorium, I recognized that Mark was probably not impressed with my prophetic powers. Are Titus and Ann Bender here? I know Titus is here, and Maria is here. Could I dare to make the three of you stand, because you are part of my introducing Dr. Harding. Just please stand for 1 second. Many of you know Titus, Ann, and Maria Bender. The reason I'm asking them to stand is back in the 1970s when I was a student at Eastern Mennonite College and my wife Joan was completing her work here, we were lost vocationally and we spent probably 2 years of Sunday evenings at Titus and Ann's and Maria's and her family's having popcorn and nachos and talking about life and meaning and where are we going in life. This family saved our lives, trekked us forward. Maria eventually came to live with us. So they are really key to how I came to be here introducing Dr. Harding. Thank you. And in turn, as I understood from talking to Titus just a few days ago, during that period, Titus was responsible for inviting Dr. Harding to speak here at what was then Eastern Mennonite College. Precisely during this period, Joan and I were trying to find our way. And I recall Dr. Harding saying something very like what we are seeing here in these words of Dr. King. And he was very clear in urging Mennonites of that day to move to the cities. And I talked to my wife, Joan, about how she remembers that period. And she says, well, she remembers Vincent sitting across from us at a table. And Joan said to him, but we're white. And Dr. Harding just looked at Joan calmly and quietly and compassionately. And he said, go. And in fact, we went. And we went precisely because we heard those words. So out of that period, I moved to seminary and became a pastoral intern at Diamond Street Mennonite Church in North Philadelphia. Joan began a life as a nurse in Philadelphia, which led to her current work in public mental health in cities all across the country. Neither of us believed that we would be where we are now if it weren't for what Titus, Ann, Maria and their family launched, and for what Dr. Vincent Harding in turn launched in our lives. So thank you, Dr. Harding. It's a real honor and a pleasure to have you here. I am not going to take more of your time with introductions. I invite any of you who have the bulletins to read in full some of the details of Dr. Harding's rich life and journey. If I have any question to kick off the conversation, it would be, what would you say to the Michael and Jones of today, or even the Michael sitting here of today? Where do we go at this point as you think of folks trying to find their ways vocationally and along the kinds of advice you gave us that changed our lives?
Good morning, everyone. I am very glad to be here with you after a long, long time of not being here with you. I don't quite remember the last time I was at Eastern Mennonite University. Someone told me it was about the middle of the 1990s. I will take their word for it because my word says nothing to me exactly. I want to work my way to respond to your question, okay? Because I'd like to make sure that everyone knows that I have been accompanied on this journey by my beloved wife, who became my wife just a couple of months ago. And I'd like to introduce my wife, Aljosie Harding. Would you stand so the others can enjoy you as well? Now, my brother, what I would like to do is to take the advantage of age and take that as an opportunity to put my question in place of yours, okay?
That's a fair move.
When I heard that there would be an opportunity for me to be with folks in the seminary chapel, I was very glad for the thought that I would be with students and faculty and others who love to explore ideas and to create new understandings. And I was especially glad that I would be with them, be with you, in a setting where I would not simply be preaching, speaking to you, but would be engaging with you in what the program says I think of as a conversation. As some of you know, I find life much more interesting when it's in dialogue than when it's a one-way street. And so I want to ask this question that is not confined to the seminary students, but available to all of you, if you would take it as a real question, not a rhetorical question, but a question that I'd like to hear a response to. And that is, when you read words like these from Martin Luther King Jr., when you hear those words, what comes to your mind? What do you think about? What do you want to ask about? How do you respond to those words? Words that King, in one form or another, spoke many times in many places. This particularly comes out of something that he had to say in Chicago in 1966. But what are you responding to? What are you hearing, feeling, as you see that? Could I see, hear from someone, anyone? We even have a roving mic to make sure that all of us hear you, if you don't mind that. One of the things that I've tried to practice here, my friend, is that whenever anyone speaks out, we begin by sharing our full name, where we spent our childhood, and if we're still spending our childhood, that's fine. Our mama's mama's full name, and where she spent her childhood. That begins to give us a little sense of the community here rather than simply isolated voices speaking up, asking, or answering questions. Your full name, where you spent your childhood, your mama's mama's full name, where she spent her childhood. And then I would love to hear your response to Martin King's statement at this point.
My name is Carol Verdine Snell Fikema.
Carolyn?
Carol.
Carol.
Carol Verdine Snell Fikema. I put the Verdine in there because that meant I was named after my grandfather and two uncles. I was raised in Iowa. My mother's name was Turi Heimdall Stoyl. She grew up in Treungen, Norway, which was named after, it means three children. That's all that were left after the Black Death went through those mountains in Norway. I was reading this. I was so moved by it. I was so glad that it was put on here because I was going to write every single word down if it wasn't. And I was identifying totally with this. I choose to identify with the underprivileged, to identify with the poor, all the way down. And then I got to, I was feeling it very strongly. And then if it means dying for them, I'm going that way. Because I heard a voice saying, I do something for others. And then I realized that that's exactly what he'd done, and he'd chosen to do that. He gave his life. But as I was going along committing myself to each statement, I realized that I would have to make that step as well. Although, I mean, that level of commitment, it's pretty profound.
All right, Carol, thank you very much. Anyone else want to share some of your response to Martin King's statement? You might want to remember that this is a statement being made by a 37-year-old man, a relatively young man.
Matt Carlson, I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia. My mother's name was Carrie Ron, and her ancestors would be from Germany. I think she grew up in Philadelphia as well. I think very simply, as I read these words from Dr. King, and as I'm contemplating where to do my practicum practicums from CJP, internships here at seminary. Where I'm thinking about doing my internship, it will inform where I decide to do that.
Good. Let him speak to you. Let him speak to you. He may not always lead you in the most pleasant of ways, Matt, but let him speak to you. He's a good man to listen to. And at the same moment, I want to call your attention to something that came out of that same period when King was talking in this way. During that year of 1966, one of the great American journalists, David Halberstam, who later became known for his reporting out of Vietnam, during 66, Halberstam traveled around with King every day for about 2 weeks and heard and felt this kind of statement. And Matt, you might want to hear what Halberstam had to say as a result of that accompanying of King. King has decided to represent the ghettos. He will work in them and speak for them. But their voice is harsh and alienated. If King is to speak for them truly, then his voice must reflect theirs. It too must be alienated. And it is likely to be increasingly at odds with the rest of American society. If you decide to accompany those who are shut out, then you have to be prepared for being in the place of the shut out. You have to be prepared for the head of the FBI to call you the most dangerous Negro in America, which is what Mr. Hoover called Dr. King at about that time in the country's life. I am very concerned that we never miss this part of Martin Luther King Jr. I am especially interested that those who are younger and who are still trying to find their way recognize that Martin Luther King chose to identify with those that he did not have to identify with. Does anybody know what kind of family King came from in terms of status in black or white America? No hands? Very middle class. Thank you. The black middle class of Atlanta. About as middle class as you can get at that time and perhaps at this time. And this man coming out of that class says in his late 30s, I choose to identify not with the power brokers, but with the poor. For me, that is a powerful statement. And it is a statement that I recognize had begun to come to him from the time that he was in seminary himself. Does anybody know where King went to seminary? Yes.
Crozier.
Crozier in the early 1950s was one of the few seminaries in the country that easily accepted African-American students. Crozier, not too far away from this place, but outside of Philadelphia. One of the things that I would like to share with you is this matter of Martin's choices. When Martin got through with Crozier, at the top of his class academically, he started then getting invitations from big churches all around the country. And for reasons that are not always totally clear, he decided that what he really wanted to do next was to go on to study some more. Most unusual man. Not too many folks, after they finish with seminary, want to go on and study some more. But he did. I gather there are some of you around here who might have some of those inclinations. King, at that point, does not again have many choices because there are relatively few PhD programs to accept African Americans. And Martin King ends up at one of the few, and fortunately, one of the best, Boston University's PhD program in philosophy and religion. It's there at Boston University that Martin makes another magnificent choice. He meets Coretta and realizes over time that this is the woman who he would like to be his partner in life. And over the years, as they grow and then they marry, one of the most important things about their choices comes up towards the end of his PhD period. The invitations are still coming in. The churches are even bigger now that he's going to have a PhD. And from all over the country, people are asking him to come and pastor what in that day we would now know as mega church. 1, 2, 3, 4. And King and Coretta make this strange decision. Instead of using their new degrees to get away from the South and all of its continuing terror, they decide that they want to go back into the South. And King, when we see him first in a public way, has made with his wife this powerful decision to go back South, not to escape, relatively escape, to the North. He makes a hard but powerful and important choice. And when we see him in the public sphere for the first time in Montgomery, Alabama, Martin has come, still scribbling on his dissertation manuscript, not quite finished yet, but planning to be a local pastor in a nice middle-class black church, and maybe to be a dean at the local black college. It is at that moment that there is another choice that I want to call your attention to. As he comes into town, he does not come riding on a great white steed. He comes in just as a new young man in town, 26 years old, with his wife. and a group of very ordinary people in that city of Montgomery who are black and full of determination not to continue to take the great indignities that they have had to suffer on the buses of Montgomery, a group of people come to him and say, Dr. King, in case you have any questions about what a PhD is for, we want to tell you. We need you to be our spokesperson in this organization that we are developing to work against the injustices of the Montgomery bus system. And Martin has to make a powerful decision, because it is not just about making speeches for the people there. What he knows, because he knows the South, is that if he becomes identified with a movement that opposes the status quo in Montgomery, he could be risking his life. And at that moment, he begins to articulate this, essentially, because he is standing with all the folks who can't afford cars, with all the maids and the porters and the janitors who are walking to work as a result of the determination to boycott the buses. He is standing with, speaking for the poor, the outcast, the beaten. And King, throughout his life, continues to go against the grain of what's expected of middle-class folks, of what's expected of PhD folks. King decides, chooses to stand with the poor, to stand with the beaten up. And by the time that we get close to the end of his life, King is talking not simply about rights, civil rights. King is talking about organizing poor people, black, white, Native Americans, everywhere, to go to Washington to demand that the government stop sending its resources to the war in Vietnam and start sending the resources that are needed to the poor and to the broken of its own society. And then, of course, we find that he makes one other choice that is deeper than he could ever really know. At the end, as he's getting ready for the Poor People's Campaign, a call comes to him from his friend, Reverend James Lawson, in Memphis, Tennessee. And the call comes because Lawson, like the wonderful pastor that he is, has decided that he doesn't simply belong in the church, but that he belongs at the side of the garbage workers who are striking. And the garbage workers asked Lawson to ask his friend King to come and help them so that the world will know that they are in trouble. And King is given another choice: to continue on a relatively understood pathway of organizing now
for a Poor People's Campaign or to interrupt it and to go to stand with garbage workers. And he chooses to stand with the garbage workers. He repeats, in essence, that statement so that it's no longer just a statement, but it's a life choice. And for me, that choice that King makes is one of the greatest challenges, I think, that is available to all of us to reflect on, to figure out what it means for us, to figure out what it costs, and to understand how to move in the light of all that. What I would like to do is just be quiet now myself and ask you, what would you like to say about all of this now? What would you like to ask about all that I have shared? What's on your mind and heart as you reflect on these things? The program calls this a conversation. It cannot work with just me.
If no one else is going to speak, I will try.
Well, you should try even if anybody else is going to speak. Give us all the information that we need.
My name is John Asa Hertzler. My mother's Rebecca Shank, and forgive me, Dr. Harding, and God, I can't remember my mother's mother's name. She was in heaven before I was born, I believe, but lived around the light of Ohio. Some persons here, like Myron Augsburg, could probably tell what my mother's mother's name is.
Well, you have a wonderful assignment for the next few weeks, so don't worry about it. Check it out.
My question is this.
You didn't tell us where you spent your childhood, though.
Oh, in Newport News, Virginia.
Okay.
Mostly. In Florida, just a few years. And in Newport News, most of my lifetime. My, question is, I guess I perceive, Doctor, you do not wear your religion on your sleeve. You don't throw the book at us. I wonder, you know, what motivates you to choose? What motivated Dr. King to choose? How does the Hebrew Christian scriptures affect your behavior? And to say a little more about that, if you will, please.
Mm. My brother, probably the best that I could say is that the first time that I began to hear Martin again and again using this kind of language, what immediately came to me was the reading that was shared with us this morning of Jesus making it very clear that his deep identity was with not the big folks, but the small folks. And that if we wanted to be with him as much as possible, maybe we ought to be with them as much as possible. I have a dear friend named James Forbes, who used to be the pastor of Riverside Church in New York. And Jim has this wonderful statement in which he says, when I read Matthew 25, it seems to me that it's saying, if you really want to go to heaven, you need a letter of recommendation from some poor people. That's the best I can do right now, okay? Some other statements, questions, comments? Wow, lots of hands. Thank
you. Dr. Harding, I see four hands, and we probably have time for only...
Two, huh?
Two. Sounds about right, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, my name is Michael Snell-Fikema, and I grew up in Wisconsin, Ohio, Minnesota, Nebraska, Iowa, but mostly places where there were a lot of hogs. My father was a hog buyer and kind of got transferred around to those places. My mother's name was Clara Lapock. That was her maiden name, and she grew up in the North Woods up in northern Wisconsin in a agricultural community of Polish immigrants. I guess what I want to talk about is how much things have changed since the time when King went to Memphis and was assassinated in this country, and how much that time had been and was a time of hope. And just when you look at King talking about war as the enemy of the poor, and he talks about the what happened to the poverty program and to the war on poverty, and how it was taken over by a demonic suction tube that directed all of those resources and that energy and commitment to the war and away from social betterment in the United States. And so many things changed in 68. The old world, I was alive. I wasn't that old, but I was alive. And it came apart. The New Deal coalition dissolved, and the political basis for strong governmental action to address problems began to disintegrate. And King talked about if any country that spends over half of its wealth on arms instead of human betterment is approaching spiritual death. Well, in those terms, we've hit spiritual death a long time ago. And I guess that in order to make concrete this kind of orientation, you need both personal action, but you also need some conception of how the institutional structures of society need to be oriented and changed. And we have been so overwhelmed by a philosophy that says government can't do anything good. Give it to the private, privatize it. Give it over to the market. Give it to corporations. They're the only ones that can do anything efficiently or well. That we've been deprived of the very ideas and orientation that was a significant part of King's hope for change and for work with the poor. And so I guess I just want to raise that up because I consider it to be a central issue. And I think it's valuable. You can say, you know, why raise up the speech written in 1968, the Beyond Vietnam speech that you wrote the first draft of? Well, it may be that go back to a time when you still had some light before you were swamped with enormous propaganda financed by the corporations and those that serve them to obliterate the idea that governmental and public action can really make a difference in people's lives, and especially in the lives of the poor and the hungry. So.
Thank you very much, my brother. And I want to encourage you to hear another part of King, which was always coming up, and that was he kept using the term, America, you must be born again. He apparently believed that that was possible. And if he could believe it, I'm going to stick with it for a while and work on that, even though everything that you say is absolutely part of the story today. But it is not all of the story. And I'm counting on people like people here, like people all over this country who are struggling to know what is the better way. I'm counting on all of you
to find the way with the help of the one who still stands with the poor and who means for the poor to be cared for. But don't let us take all the time on it now. We'll catch each other afterwards, okay? Because a couple of other people wanted to come in on the conversation.
Good afternoon again, Dr. Hart.
Good afternoon.
This is Shirley from Chicago again.
All right. My friend Shirley.
Praise the Lord all day long. Martin Luther King made many choices in his life, and he made those choices with compassion and for the people. But what I wanted to do today, because the letter that he wrote in Birmingham was very significant in his goals in helping people. People who are here that want to do things to help the poor, want to service the poor, and those individuals get knocked down. They are labeling, saying you can't do it, but they have the compassion, they have the ability, and they have the want. What would you tell them about not giving up and keep on the pathway of enduring their dreams? They need to hear that word from you to say, continue on, because Martin Luther King did just that.
I would tell them to listen to you, because you're telling them exactly what to do. There was a hand down by the aisle here, friends.
And we should make that the
that's the last one.
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Hardin. My name is Carlos Madrid. I am from Honduras, and my mother's name was Maria Zavala, and she was a native Honduran from her country, and she just passed away at age 92, 2009. I used to live in Chicago myself, and I heard Reverend Jackson from 1998 to 2002, and it is interesting to meet you today. And by reading that statement from Dr. King, it's amazing. It's amazing the invitation that he felt to fight for others. And on your dissertation, or let me say your introduction to your new book, back on the day before yesterday, you were mentioning that you met Dr. King in 1958, and you felt compelled or invited to participate alongside with him. What was exactly that make you feel or steer your gears toward choosing to go alongside with Dr. King? Since we have you here today, what is that can encourage us to think in that part of the testimony that I haven't heard myself?
All right. Thank you for that. Tell me your first name again.
Carlos.
Carlos. My brother, I really need deeply to say that part of what made me open to King's invitation and, in a sense, ready for King's invitation was the kind of friendship and fellowship and community that I had begun to find by that time among my Mennonite sisters and brothers, that I knew that for all of our shortcomings, that there was a community of people who at its best was trying to take Jesus seriously. And King understood that too, because when we first met him, the other black guy and me, Ed Riddick was his name, he said to us, well, you guys are Mennonites. You know about this nonviolence that we're trying to carry out here. You were to come and help us. And so Martin knew something of his Anabaptist history, probably from those wonderful seminary courses that he taught, if not from day-to-day contact with people like Brother Hirschberger. I think that that's what I would say, that I was already opened to that kind of engagement by the deep connections that I had made by that time with my Mennonite sisters and brothers. And it's one of the reasons why I will always celebrate that communion, sometimes at the same moment as speaking very harshly to that community, because I believe that we have so much to offer our society and our world if we will only take ourselves seriously and take our master seriously and not be afraid to step out in areas that are dangerous, that are unknown, that are easily criticized. But I feel, Carlos, that this community was part of the prepping for me for that invitation from Martin King.
Thank you, Dr. Harding, for wonderful words to carry forth with us. I'm going to invite Professor David Evans here at Eastern Mennonite Seminary to offer us words of sending. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, Al Josey and Vincent Harding, we thank you so much for being with us, for opening up yourselves to us, your story, your words, your wisdom. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. Dr. Harding has opened up a conversation. In the program, it says this is a closing. I don't hope to close that conversation. But as he has done, I invite us to continue this conversation. He's invited us to consider that the process is important, not just the product. And so we continue on. And so I'm left with these questions that I invite you to consider with me. Not for me alone, not for only those of us who sit here this morning or now this afternoon, but for all of us in this Eastern Mennonite University campus, at Eastern Mennonite Seminary, our staff, our student body, our faculty, our neighbors as well. We are at an important juncture in the life of our university and our community together. So I ask, with whom will we choose to identify? Will we choose to live our lives to make our institution and our community for those whom Howard Thurman called those who live with their backs perpetually against the wall? Will we go this way? What if it means suffering a little bit? What if it means sacrificing? What if it means dying for them? Do we want to go this way? Dr. King said, I'm going that way because I heard a voice saying, do something for others. Will we choose to go this way because we've heard Dr. Harding say that life is better in dialogue? Will we choose to go this way because we've heard Dr. Harding say we can't go this way alone? Will we choose to go this way because we have heard a voice say to us, whatever you do, To the least of these, my family members, you do also unto me. Which way will we choose to go?